Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for July 31st, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, assessing ecological restoration, rethinking graduate student funding, and your letters to science, which are all about science in Venezuela. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about a cloaking device for earthquakes, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
There are many ways to reverse the environmental degradation caused by human activities, including actively planting grasses and reintroducing carnivores, or passively just stopping the degrading activity and letting nature take its course. Now, in a paper published online by Science, James Bullock and colleagues report their meta-analysis of 89 published studies on ecological restoration that shows that ecological restoration has its benefits, but on average is not nearly as good an outcome for a land or water system as preserving and maintaining the pristine ecosystem in the first place. I spoke with Bullock from England. Bullock works at the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology.
We were interested in trying to understand whether restoration works, where restoration is the recreation of systems on degraded land. So that's number one, whether it works, whether it delivers biodiversity. The other aspect was looking at ecosystem services, which is a new concept in biodiversity science, where ecosystem services are the services or the benefits that are provided by nature and ecosystems to humankind, such as provisioning of food and timber, storing carbon, providing quality water, a wide range of things such as that. It's a concept that's gained a lot of interest over the last few years, but has been hardly studied. In particular, the idea that increased biodiversity will give us increased ecosystem services. And in this study, we indeed found that restoration, increasing biodiversity, also increased these services. But an equally strong outcome of our study was that the pristine systems were still better on average for ecosystem services and biodiversity than the restored system. Now, this may be an aspect of time, but it may be an aspect of restoration that on average will never quite get there, will never get as good an outcome as conserving or maintaining the pristine system. So we feel that's a very strong message to come from our study, that restoration science has developed strongly over the last few decades. It's a very important approach to restore degraded land, but it is not the overall answer. The answer still is to maintain and conserve pristine systems if we want to have the best possible biodiversity and the best possible ecosystem services.
At what point is a plot of land or body of water or length of river considered to be ecologically restored?
That's quite an interesting question because, well, there's a lot of discussion in restoration ecology over when is a system degraded, number one, and when do you get it back to something that you would decide is as good as new, if you like. And there are a range of concepts there. What we did is take what the individual studies had taken as an endpoint, and this is a very important part of our study, where we looked at studies where people had measured systems under restoration, degraded systems, but also target or reference systems, as we call them, which were pristine systems, wild systems, if you like. The people doing these studies were trying to restore their degraded systems back to. So this is very clear from their studies. They themselves set that endpoint as something which we would see as a pristine or undisturbed by humans.
How did you and your team choose those restoration studies on which you all conducted your analysis?
Well, this is another important aspect. We call this approach a meta-analysis, and it's systematic as well, where we aim to be totally unbiased in the studies we take to analyze. So number one, we did a trawl through bibliographic databases to find studies that met a certain number of criteria. One of those was, as I just said, studies which had looked at restored systems, but also degraded, but also reference or pristine systems. Studies that had provided clear measures of biodiversity and ecosystem processes in each of these three system types. But otherwise, we were totally unbiased. We just took everything that was given to us by the bibliographic databases.
Did the results vary? That is, were there any places, ecosystems, where restoration, at least to the satisfaction of those doing the original studies, had greater or lesser effect on the benefits people obtained from the ecosystems once the restoration activity was complete?
That's a complex question. Number one, yes, outcomes did vary hugely. They varied partly because of time, how long the restoration happened. Restoration had been going in some cases for less than 5 years and for other cases over more than several hundred years.
That's in the case where farming stopped or something like that?
Yes, that's very much the passive restoration approach where the people had taken out forest and farmed on it or taken out some other type of scrubland or prairie and converted to arable farming but had then abandoned it. So the very old restorations are very much the passive or abandonment type of thing. But the variation in outcome had a number of other drivers, if you like. We're not quite clear yet. We're analyzing the data further to work that out. But certainly looking at the different types of system involved, we found that somewhat surprisingly, tropical terrestrial systems in general restored best in terms of both ecosystem services and biodiversity. And it's the aquatic systems that restored worse. And before you ask me, we're not quite sure why that is. It may be because in some of the aquatic restorations, people are trying to do very complex things such as restore reef systems. Also in freshwater systems, they're trying to create these sinuous rivers from canalized rivers. So they're doing very complex, expensive, and detailed restorations. So that may be the reason why they're not working so well there. Or they may take a long time for the system to settle down as to get the full benefits. But the other aspect of the question was, did people get the ecosystem services they were hoping for? Now, this is a very interesting aspect of our study, that only about 12% of the studies we looked at did people specifically mention ecosystem services or ecosystem processes per se. They were often measuring biodiversity, fine, they're very interested in the biodiversity outcomes, so they measure that, but also measuring other aspects of the ecosystem, such as microbial activity, the carbon content of the soil, the quality of the water, the heavy metal content of the soil. But they're not generally in these studies putting together in the concept of ecosystem services. We came in and put this concept over those studies as a way of bringing them all together and trying to understand how this new concept of ecosystem services might be applied to some older data. And this was the interesting, exciting aspect of the study, that indeed this was a very useful concept for bringing together a great range of studies, as I've described, a huge different number of measures taken. But the ecosystem service concept really allowed us to bring together these very different studies and get general rules out of them all.
Is it possible that a similar-sized selection of a different set of restoration studies would show a different result? That is, that enhancing biodiversity doesn't increase the benefits people obtain from ecosystems?
I think that's highly unlikely. Number one, I think the approach we used meant we had the strongest possible set of comparators or a way of looking at this question by, as I say, using studies that only had a very good comparison of the restored system with the degraded, with the reference or pristine system. So we chose the most appropriate studies to really answer this question. The other thing is that by the analytical tools we use, the statistical tools, this is a very strong signal we're getting from these studies. Despite the great range of studies looked at, this is a signal that's coming through very clear and strong. And so I would imagine that the more studies we added to this, even if we lessened our criteria for inclusion, we would still get this strong signal coming through. In fact, it'd be quite interesting if people, other ecologists who read this, who were maybe skeptical with it, actually started looking at some of the other studies that maybe are unpublished or are less high quality, I guess, is the word I'm trying to look for, to actually really put our conclusions to the test. But I would be very, very surprised if they came up with any other conclusion than we did. We think this is a very, very strong conclusion. Certainly in the refereeing process, we went through some debates about that, and everyone came to the same conclusion. Yes, this is a very clear and robust outcome of our study.
Well, James Bullock, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Rob.
James Bullock of the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology is senior author of a paper on a meta-analysis of studies of ecological restoration. Find the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. It's part of a special section this week on the rise of restoration ecology. A U.S. government report is questioning the planned relocation site for a biosecurity lab to the state of Kansas. Here with more about it is Science Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel.
In January 2009, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, chose Manhattan, Kansas as the location for the new National Bio and Agro Defense Facility. This would replace the aging Plum Island Animal Defense Center, located off the coast of New York's Long Island. This remote facility deals with highly infectious pathogens related to dangerous animal diseases. The decision pleased Kansas politicians, including then-Governor Kathleen Sebelius, who now serves as U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services. But critics, particularly from other states that were under consideration, complained that the process had been politicized. A group from Texas sued the DHS in protest of the decision. That lawsuit was recently dismissed. But an upcoming report by the Federal Government Accountability Office, or GAO, is lending credence to the critics. According to an advanced draft obtained by the Washington Post, the report states that the DHS analysis and decision were not scientifically defensible. But the Texans and others who wanted the new lab for their own states should take note. The GAO not only concluded that tornado-prone Kansas is a potentially unsafe place to harbor dangerous animal diseases, but that any location on the U.S. mainland could be too risky. What's next? At least one congressional hearing has been scheduled to discuss the topic, and if congressional appropriators so choose, they could withhold funding for construction of the facility.
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. In the United States, most science graduate students don't pay a penny to earn their doctorates. Instead, funding, largely from government institutions such as the National Institutes of Health or National Science Foundation, comes in the form of grants usually awarded to professors, who in turn use it to fund the research the students do. But as Science's Jeffrey Mervis reports in this week's issue, there's a new proposal to change that funding mechanism to one that awards the money to the students to use at the institutions of their choice.
What being proposed would be changing how the federal government supports graduate education to make it more closely tied to the needs of the graduate students and the quality of undergraduate education than the needs of the researchers getting the research done.
Who's saying that this change in how science students are currently funded by the U.S. government should be done, and why?
Right. This is an idea from Nobel laureate Roald Hoffman of Cornell University, who has been thinking about this issue for a long time and more recently has been troubled by the effect of the current recession on undergraduate education.
So what would be involved then in the switch?
Right. What it would mean is that federal agencies like the National Science Foundation and National Institutes of Health would shift the money that they are now giving to principal investigators, which is used to hire graduate students, and move it into what Hoffman is advocating, which would be portable competitive fellowships that students would apply for and receive and then be free to go to whatever university they chose. Under the current system, the grant goes to the university and the PI and is tied very closely to that investigator's work. Under the fellowship model, students would have much more flexibility to come up with their own projects and find the right investigator who would like to work with them, and they'd be bringing their own money.
So would the graduate students then, before they became graduate students, have to come up with such a project? I mean, are they typically in a position to be able to create a competitive fellowship proposal?
It's a good question. I think that programs like the NSF Graduate Research Fellowship are really looking for talented people that are creative and have ideas. They're not expecting the students to have a fully fleshed out research agenda. It's more the potential and the promise that the student brings, and NSF's bet that they will be able to, you know, be productive and hopefully, you know, become a career scientist.
How might that shift in funding structure to fellowships directly to students affect the researchers, faculty, universities, and their work?
Well, that's the big question. And I think that's why some people who are opposed to this, or at least skeptical, are worried about. Under the current system, principal investigators hire graduate students to be able to complete the project that they have proposed to the agency and gotten money for. And so they're relying on graduate students to do that labor. The graduate students are also hired as teaching assistants to help with undergraduate courses. And what Hoffman is saying is that under the current squeeze, undergraduate education could be hurt, whereas the research component of a university would escape relatively unscathed because that's federal money that's not under the control of the university. The university pays for the undergraduate instruction through tuition and fees or through subsidies from the state legislature if they're a public university.
So it's basically a kind of an optimization problem, trying to do the best by the lecturers, the graduate students, the undergraduate institution, as well as the graduate institution.
Right. It is a complicated structure that you want to balance. What Hoffman and some others have saying has happened over the last 20 years is that it's been tilted toward the research enterprise, and that has also not coincidentally led to what many people believe is an overproduction in some fields, especially in the life sciences, to the point where you have graduate students not knowing whether they can get jobs, becoming postdocs, and then postdocs not knowing whether they can get jobs. Under Hoffman's proposal, you would have fewer people going through the pipeline, which he and others say might not be such a bad thing, as long as the quality is good and their experience is top-notch.
Who's on board with this idea, and who still needs to be persuaded before this kind of funding structure change happens?
Well, there's a lot of inertia in the community, and that may not be a bad thing, because this would be a fundamental shift. And so a lot of people, including economists, are saying, we need to model this better. We're not quite sure what the impact would be, and before we do something drastic, we want to make sure. After all, the U.S. system now is, by all accounts, the most productive in the world, and U.S. higher education is the envy of every other country, and no one wants to mess that up. But what Hoffman and others are saying is that it is distorted, and it could get worse as the economy gets worse unless we do something, and this is the something that they're proposing.
Are Hoffman and others completely convinced, or are there things about this proposal to change the funding system that bother him and might bother others too?
Well, the biggest thing, and Hoffman acknowledges this, is that if you shift to fellowships, that there would be a reduction in the number of foreign students that are now supported by federal U.S. dollars at U.S. universities. And that's because under the current practices, fellowships are generally restricted to Americans on the idea that taxpayer money should be going to American students. Now, that could change. It's not written in stone, but he admits that there would be a drop-off in all likelihood of students from China and India and other places, and that that would be a disadvantage. But he feels that the advantages outweigh that. Other people are not sure that that's the case. The second problem is that if graduate students have the choice, historically they've gone to the elite universities. There is a gap, and many people say this gap would widen, and that that would hurt hundreds of universities around the country that aren't in the top 20 or the top 50 or the top tier in any case, and that that's not good for the country, and that it's not good for geographic diversity.
What would be the mechanism for this actual change, and have any of the steps towards this change already happened?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, and the U.S. system is structured so that it couldn't happen overnight. Every agency supports graduate students in its own way, and over time, this system has evolved, and universities have adapted to fit this system. So changes would have to come gradually, and they might have to come agency by agency, and therefore there might be time to see how the model is evolving and to make changes if there are obvious problems as it begins to be implemented. On the other hand, there is no overarching legislation that would prevent something like this from happening if the community and the federal government felt that it was in the best interest of science. But right now, there is no proposal on the table before Congress or before any of the agencies. And Dr. Hoffman admits that he's putting out the idea for discussion more than for immediate implementation.
Jeffrey Mervis, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Science's Jeffrey Mervis reports on a proposed change in how the U.S. government funds graduate students in science. Now, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about a cloaking device for earthquakes. Now, Dave, this is cloaking other objects from earthquakes, right? Not cloaking earthquakes from other objects.
No, that would be a bad thing, Rob. We wouldn't want to cloak earthquakes. We want to protect buildings from earthquakes. And the question is there a high-tech or maybe even a sci-fi way to do it? And this team's idea is to cloak buildings and houses and other objects from earthquakes.
Sci-fi is science fiction, but we're in the realm of real science here, aren't we?
Well, we are. And it turns out this idea is actually not as far-fetched as you would think. If you think of a stealth bomber, for example, this is a plane, you know, developed by the military that's very good at evading radar. And radar is basically waves. And the way the plane evades waves is it's built from special materials that are in a special configuration that the plane either absorbs or reflects these waves in a way that keeps them from bouncing back and being detected by the radar. And these researchers have proposed a similar concept for earthquakes, which, when you think about it, earthquakes are also waves. They're very powerful waves that emanate from deep within the earth.
So the cloaking wouldn't be to keep them from deflecting in a certain way, as with the airplanes, but to literally either completely absorb them or make the buildings completely invisible.
Exactly. Now, the researchers didn't actually do this in the real world. What they did was they ran some simulations. And to create their earthquake cloaking device, they simulated a series of concentric rings that were made of plastic, copper, and a few other materials. And they were arranged in a very special way. And what they did was they put this virtual device into a simulation, and they simulated earthquake waves traveling at this device. And what they saw, and you can see pictures of this on the site, is when they had a regular building in their simulation, these waves hit the building, there was a lot of distortion of the waves around the building, sort of what you would expect with an earthquake. And because these waves carry the energy of several nuclear bombs, you would see in real life what they saw in the simulation, which essentially would be the building being destroyed. But when they reran the simulation with their cloaking device, all of a sudden it seemed like the waves were passing right through the device. There was no distortion, there was nothing that they saw in the simulation that would indicate that the device even felt these waves. It was as if the device was completely invisible to these earthquake waves.
How would you implement something like this?
The idea with something like this would be that you would have your building and you would make the base of the building out of this cloaking device. And the idea would be because waves travel from deep within the earth, as they travel to the surface, they're going to hit the base of the building first. And if the base of the building is invisible to these waves, the idea would be that the building as a whole would not feel this shaking.
When do we see a prototype?
Well, even though we said that this isn't science fiction and there are, you know, relatives of this type of device out there right now, experts are still saying it's going to be a long time before we would see something like this. It still is in the virtual phase, and it's going to take a lot more work before we actually see these things on buildings and houses.
Okay. What other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from shaking to stirring, and this next story is all about how the oceans get stirred up.
Why are scientists studying the stirring of the ocean?
Well, it turns out that the oceans actually need to get stirred up to distribute all of the nutrients and heat. If you think about the ocean surface, that's getting hit with a lot of sunlight, so there's a lot of heat up there, and there's also a lot of nutrients up there.
From the phytoplankton and things like that.
Exactly. And the ocean surface is a very active place. I mean, there's a lot of turbulence, there's the tides and the waves and everything, and so you can imagine at the surface, there's a lot of this stuff is getting mixed up. But the question is, how does all this heat and the nutrients get down to the ocean depths?
So there are chemical things going on at the bottom of the ocean, and there's sunlight and plants and heat going on at the top of the ocean. the stirring then would sort of make it a mixture for those creatures living in the middle of the ocean.
Exactly. If you think about the ocean ideally should be something like a blender where everything gets distributed evenly, or at least in a way that these creatures in the middle don't miss out on the nutrients and the heat.
And don't have to travel to the top or to the bottom to get what they need.
Exactly. But there's really been a lack of an explanation for how this happens, because although you have all this activity at the surface, once you start getting further down, things seem a lot calmer. So it doesn't look like there's mixing going on. But maybe all the fish in the sea, all the motion of these fish swimming around sort of acts like a giant blender. And the motions of the fish themselves are enough to blend all of these ingredients together.
So scientists have simulated the entire ocean and filled it with simulated fish to test this?
Not exactly. They actually focused on one particular fish called the Mystygius jellyfish. It's also known as the moon jellyfish. And the reason they focused on this particular type of fish is because it's very slow moving and it's got a radial symmetry, which means it looks a bit like a wheel. So it's very easy to model the type of interactions that this jellyfish has with the water. And what the researchers did was they went into a lagoon with these jellyfish and they put some green dye right ahead of the jellyfish and had the jellyfish swim into the dye. And they could see the dye being churned around as the jellyfish swim. And you can actually see a really neat video of this with the story. Now, one jellyfish obviously isn't enough to cause massive ocean circulation, but these jellyfish travel in these giant hordes, you know, thousands upon thousands of jellyfish. And when you take into account all of those jellyfish, plus all of the other fish in the sea, the researchers speculate that you've got about a trillion watts of energy. This is a tremendous amount of energy. In fact, it's as much energy as the winds and the tides contribute to the ocean. So you're talking about a massive amount of mixing that can be done by these large groups of motile creatures in the ocean.
Now, if so much of this mixing then is done by these creatures, would there be sort of a positive feedback if overfishing or climate change led to the demise of these creatures?
Well, yeah, you can imagine that might be a possibility. The ocean is really dependent on all of these fish for churning all of these ingredients together. And you have overfishing, so you have less fish, and there's less churning going on, and then there's less of this heat and nutrients being distributed to these fish, and you have less fish. You can imagine this snowball effect where potentially overfishing could really lead to a loss of this blender, as it were, in the world's oceans. Although that's really speculation at this point. Researchers obviously need to do a lot more work into that.
Okay. Well, last one then. What's this last story about?
Well, Rob, from creatures racing around the sea to a tree that seems to be stuck. And it's not stuck in a place, it seems to be stuck in time.
How so?
Well, this is a tree from New Zealand. It's called the lancewood tree. And the lancewood tree has a very peculiar biology. As a seedling, the tree has these brown, blotchy leaves. As it grows up to a sapling, these leaves turn into these foot-long spears that almost look like arrows in reverse. And finally, as a full adult, its leaves are very nondescript. They're the standard sort of green leaves you see on most trees. And so this is a lot of changing that this tree undergoes as it grows up.
What would be the evolutionary advantage to the tree having these features in its development?
Well, the researchers in this study came up with a very interesting hypothesis. They think the tree is defending itself from a giant flightless bird known as the moa. But there's just one problem, Rob. The moa went extinct 500 years ago, and this tree is still around and still seemingly defending itself from this bird. But, you know, before they went too far with this hypothesis, they wanted to try to show that this was actually the case.
Are there any relatives to either the tree or the moa that would help?
Great question. And indeed, the researchers found a very close relative of this tree on a chain of islands called the Chatham Islands, which are about 800 kilometers to the east of New Zealand. And the moa actually also has some relatives. It's a close relative of emus and ostriches. But for this study, they compared the tree relatives. So they compared the New Zealand tree to this Chatham tree. And the first thing they did was they looked at the seedlings of both trees. So these are, you know, very small sprouts that the tree would start out as. And they shined some light on the leaves of the seedlings. And they measured what kind of wavelength and brightness of light was reflected. And what they found with the New Zealand tree was that the light was very similar to the light that was reflected off dead leaves from the forest floor.
prompting the moa not to bend down to eat it.
That would be the idea. The moa, you know, sees these leaves on the ground and just figures this is a dead tree and wouldn't eat them. So that's the first evidence for the moa hypothesis. And the Chatham tree did not have leaves like this. Its leaves did not resemble dead leaves. So the next thing the researchers looked at were the saplings for both trees. And this time they looked at these really spiky leaves that I talked about for the New Zealand tree. And again, the Chatham tree doesn't have this. And the researchers, what was really interesting about the spikes or the thorns on these leaves is there's a really bright coloration with them. And again, you can see this photo on the site. And the researchers suspect that this coloration was a warning to the moa saying, don't eat these leaves, otherwise it's going to be like swallowing an arrow. And again, the Chatham tree doesn't have that kind of adaptation. And finally, they looked at the adult trees. And with the adult trees, there really isn't much difference between the Chatham tree and the New Zealand tree. And the idea is by the time the tree grows into an adult, it's so big that the moa really isn't trying to eat it anymore. The moa is really looking for stuff more on the forest floor. And so all these adaptations, while not proof, are highly suggestive that the tree was defending itself from the moa.
Was the moa the only creature eating this type of tree?
Well, that's the idea. That's why they're so focused on the moa. The moa was really the only large herbivore on this island that really would have targeted a plant like the lancewood tree. So the idea is if the plant's defending itself from anything, it would be defending itself from the moa. But again, the moa has been gone for 500 years. So this is an example of a nice evolutionary adaptation, but one that's sort of whose time has come and gone because the plant doesn't really need to defend itself anymore.
Now, you said this was a hypothesis. What would make for a further test of this hypothesis? Why still a hypothesis at this point?
Well, Rob, we talked about earlier how the moa is related to emus and ostriches. And so one expert suggested, well, let's put emus and ostriches into this equation now and see if they are repelled by these barbed leaves and are confused by these leaves that look like dead leaves to see if perhaps the moa would have reacted in the same way.
So a test still to come.
Exactly.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into stories about stressing out mice and what kind of habits stress encodes in the brain. And also a story about making brown fat. Brown fat is this type of fat that burns a lot of calories and generates a lot of heat. And researchers are trying to figure out if there's a way to use this fat therapeutically, perhaps to help people lose weight. And for the science policy blog, Science Insider, we're looking into a story about NIH funding. Some things are changing with funding the National Institutes of Health, and we've got an item on that. And also about a series of studies relating to AIDS and prostitutes and how these studies got killed by Congress. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. Finally today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is the letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
We have three letters in this week's issue, and they all have to do with science in Venezuela. The first is from the country's Minister for Science, Technology, and Intermediate Industry, Jesse Chacon Escamillo, who writes in response to a May 29th News of the Week story called, As Research Funding Declines, Chavez Scientists Trade Charges.
In that article, freelance writer Barbara Casasus reported on Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez's television remarks that researchers should stop working on obscure projects and make themselves useful. In addition, Casasus noted, Chavez had commented that his recently appointed Minister for Science, Technology, and Intermediate Industry should put the screws on feeble scientists to get better results.
Chacon Escamillo, the science minister in question, writes in response this week, The Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela is currently in the 10th year of a revolution aimed at improving the health, welfare, education, and culture of all Venezuelans. In fact, the Bolivarian government has improved Venezuelan science in a number of ways, including the number of students and researchers, greater internet access and computer literacy throughout the country, as well as a higher percentage of Venezuela's gross domestic product for research and development.
Chacon Escamillo also takes issue with the arguments of a previous letter, Venezuelan Science at Risk, by Claudio Bifano, published in Science's June 19th issue. Bifano, who is president of the Venezuelan Academy of Physical, Mathematical, and Natural Sciences, wrote to communicate his organization's fears for the present and future fate of science and education in Venezuela.
It is astonishing, Chacon Escamillo writes in response, that Bufano believes this to be a worrisome development or a national threat. It is not true, Chacon Escamillo continues, that there is a loss of intellectual capital in Venezuela. It is also false that the government fired, demoted, or blacklisted dissident scientists. The short-term study in the News Focus was sponsored and published by a private foundation belonging to a consortium that participated in the economic sabotage orchestrated by the opposition before and during the April 2002 coup d'etat against President Chavez, and the subsequent commercial lockout in December of that year. For these reasons, the Bolivarian government considers this work biased and unreliable.
We received a second response to Claudio Bufano's letter from Guillermo Barreto of the Simón Bolívar University in Venezuela, who finds Bufano's concerns about the future of Venezuelan science and education unfounded. Barreto writes, "Bufano worries about the fact that the government is establishing national research priorities, but it is the government's duty to make such decisions and to promote scientific research that addresses the country's problems. Bufano is concerned about the creation of new universities, but many young scientists who would otherwise be excluded from the already crowded traditional universities are now pursuing their careers through attending these new institutions. He speaks about budget cuts, but overall spending on science has quadrupled, reaching 2.1% of the gross domestic product in 2007.
Our final letter this week on Venezuelan science comes from Jamie Requena, formerly of Venezuela's Institute for Advanced Studies, or IDEA. He writes, "In that May 29th News of the Week story, the president of IDEA explains the reasons for my dismissal from the institution, after 27 years as an employee and a total of 41 years serving Venezuelan science. As the most senior professor at IDEA until my dismissal, I would like to defend myself, a right that has been denied to me in my country."
You can read the details of Requena's defense, as well as the other two letters about science in Venezuela, in this week's issue. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor of Science Magazine. And that wraps up the July 31st, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.